Sure is. And Annie Jacobson, our special guest. We're going to take phone calls with her this hour as we continue talking about Operation Paperclip. And also, don't forget her other work, which, of course, is Area 51. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Annie, in your work, of course, for Operation Paperclip, did you come across anything that just shocked you, that surprised you, that you did not know prior to getting involved?
You know, I would have to say it was coming across these journals by the general and seeing the sort of familial way in which these high-ranking former Nazis and current high-ranking American officers worked together and really respected one another in their efforts to beat the Soviets. I really didn't expect to see it on paper like that.
Now, who did the Soviets get that might have had any notoriety?
You know, it's a bit obscure. They had their own program. It was called Operation Oskievem. And the primary focus was on the V weapons and also on chemical weapons. And as I mentioned, when the Russians moved, you know, were headed to Berlin, they were able to take over those chemical weapons factories and make them their own. And there was this 1950s kind of race behind the scenes between the Americans and the Soviets who to build the bigger arsenal of the more deadly weapons, and sarin was the, you know, was the result of that. And it's amazing how you see that legacy today in Syria, in Iraq, and elsewhere. And also, as I write in the end of the book, we spent hundreds of millions of dollars then destroying the chemical weapons that we spent so much money building.
Yeah, exactly. I bet the Nazis who went to the Soviet Union probably thought that they were going to the gulag. They probably hated every day.
Yes, and there's, you know, there's a great little detail where, because as we mentioned earlier, the Soviets hated the Germans and vice versa. And so the Soviets really did what Operation Paperclip intended to do, which was grab the Germans, squeeze the information out of them, and send them back home. That's what the Russians did. And in the 1950s, the Russians sent all the rocket scientists they had back to Berlin. And CIA initiated an operation called Operation Dragon Return, a great name. And we sent off CIA officers to track down these Nazi weapons designers who were worked for and then released by the Soviets, to find out, you know, everything we could about their weapons programs. And the great irony was that, according to these CIA documents, we discovered that the Germans didn't really know that much about the Soviet programs because they were kept out of the top tier need to know, because there was that, you know, they hated each other so much.
Yeah, the Russians played it close to their vest, didn't they?
Yes.
All right, let's go to the phones. Frank is in Hollywood, Maryland. Welcome to the program. Frank, you're on with us.
I'm George. Glad to be back with you. I must have set an all-time record. I got waited on in 2 minutes.
How about that?
My question is, I'm a 240 hitting Catholic. I want to know why the Catholic Church would help a Nazi, harbor a Nazi, and then why didn't they go after these South American leaders who harbored Nazis after the war?
Well, it's a great
the thing about this.
It's a great question.
I believe
it's
invented a DNA. I keep getting this thought in my mind.
All right, let's check into that. Go ahead.
So the first part of your question about the Catholic Church, I'm not an expert on the Catholic Church, but I must say there's been some great books written on that. So, and I'm forgetting the name of a new one that came out this year, but that's an interesting subject. What I can tell you about is why didn't we go after these South American leaders who were, you know, harboring Nazis, inviting Nazis in? And the reason was absolutely because we were doing the same thing. And there are some interesting cables, State Department cables, that go back and forth, you know, that discuss this issue, which is basically people within the State Department saying, you know, how can we go out publicly saying, you know, we must go after these South American leaders when in fact we're doing the same thing?
You know, there was a book written about the Pope that he aided the Nazis as well, the Pope of that era. And during
World
War II.
Yeah, that's the book I'm thinking about. Didn't it just publish this winter?
I think it's at least several years old. They may have come out with a second edition of it. That's very possible.
It's a very, very interesting story.
All right, let's go to Dennis now in Philadelphia for you. Dennis, go ahead. You're up with us.
Good morning, folks. Yeah, I have a very unique experience. I used to have a talk show back in the early 90s in Philadelphia here. And one week, I had a gentleman on from the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. Well, you know, we were talking about their issues and everything. Then the week after, I was speaking about this issue, Operation Paperclip, and plus the chemical and biological warfare experiments that were being held on the American people, unbeknownst to them, such as mentally retarded adults being fed radioactive oatmeal, pregnant women who thought they were getting prenatal care up and down the East Coast. There was various hospitals that were involved in this. They were feeding women radioactive iodine tablets and so forth. Well, while I was doing my show, my phone, the phone in the office, was ringing incessantly at 6 o'clock in the morning, which I thought was weird. Well, right after the show, the gentleman who was on my show from that organization the week before called me on the phone and said he had a warning for me. He said, people were calling the office trying to get me pulled off the air from speaking about this. He said, and I was warned to stop speaking about this. Now, right after he gave me that phone call, he vanished from the organization, so he was obviously a plant spying on that organization. And since he was on my show the week before, and they heard what I was speaking about,
they blew his cover.
Right? Yeah, he blew his cover, and he vanished from the organization. But there was a bunch of heinous experiments being conducted on the American people by the very people that we were fighting back in the 40s. And they said it was going on from the late 40s up until the early 90s. I think it's still going on. But that was my experience with this, and I just stopped doing my show because I was caring for my mother then, and I said to myself, something happens to me, who's going to care for my mom? So I switched that from doing political talk to playing oldies. So,
so that'll keep you alive.
Well, my trash bags were vanishing on me. My phone was being tapped. My mail was coming open, and I said, you know, I better just lay off with this. So,
well, that brings up a question for you, Annie, about the New World Order and how much the Nazis might have been involved, or they are involved in it.
Well, that's such an interesting topic, and there's endless research going on into it. And I think what I found fascinating was the role of John McCloy in that. And he's sort of the bald guy that always appears in the photographs of the Illuminati. And he was the first president of the World Bank, and then he became U.S. High Commissioner to Germany, and he played a really kind of central role in all these major events of that period, including releasing the Nazi war criminals from the Nuremberg prison so that Germany could, you know, get itself back on its feet. And I think people continue to research these areas where the questions have not yet been answered. And your caller touched upon that as well in referring to these Atomic Energy Commission plutonium experiments that were going on all throughout the Cold War. You kind of have layers of revelations in different decades. And I find it an endlessly interesting subject, and I'm so glad that so many other people do as well, because I always think the truth gets revealed if you stay on it long enough.
Let's go to Portland, Oregon. Michael's with us west of the Rockies. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Annie if she came across in our research anything that's on Brown or, you know, any of the other rocket scientists were involved in black project-wise, like time travel, age regression, things that would be, you know, derivatives of you know, backward engineered alien crashes and that sort of thing. And the reason I ask, I found out later in life that I'm actually an illegitimate child of Von Braun. And I, when I brought this to my dad's attention, my adopted father, he confirmed it. And I'm actually writing a book right now. I'm having it ghostwritten. And it's going to divulge some of the stuff that I came across and that have, you know, has been divulged to me. But I just wondered if Annie had come across anything like that.
Let me ask you a couple quick questions, Michael, before we get to Annie on this. So I assume it was your mother who had the affair with Von Braun, or were these both adopted parents that she had?
I was an adopted child, and I was told growing up that I was adopted and that my father worked in the same general line of work that my adopted father did. And my adopted father worked for one of the intelligence agencies on the early drone project down in southern Arizona. I was born in Tucson, Arizona. My dad was at Fort Bliss, actually teaching electronics in the Army when some of the Germans were still there at Fort Bliss. So I was raised knowing that, you know, my biological father worked in the military industrial complex like my adopted father did. And I was told that my mother was much younger and that they were from the eastern side of the country. You know, that's when I'm living in Arizona, of course. And later in life, like when I'm in sixth grade, I'm no longer a kid, you know, a little kid. I'm out building rockets and flying airplanes and playing sports and that sort of thing. We actually get transferred wherever Von Braun is living, like in, my dad was at White Sands Missile Range and we lived in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and everybody on my dad's team got laid off except my dad. And this was in 1969 when we were landing on the moon, and they transfer us to Huntsville, Alabama.
Oh, really? Huh.
And there's no job there for my dad. My dad tells us that there is no job. They're just holding me over until the next contract, which is going to be Alexandria, Virginia. And, of course, you know, I didn't know any of this growing up as a kid. But we get transferred to Alexandria, Virginia in 1970, same time that Von Braun gets transferred there. You know, he's made.
Did you ever meet Von Braun?
Yes, George, I have, and this is if I told you how this came about, and I told my father about this, and he got a big smirk on his face and said, oh, you were finally told. Tell me about it.
Uh-huh.
I told him the circumstances, because this involves age regression and time travel, and my father said, if you told anybody about this, they'd probably think you're crazy, right? And I go, well, yeah, no kidding. And he said, Michael, you need to write a book about this. And I said, yeah, right, and get bumped off. You must be crazy.
Did Von Braun know that he may have been your father?
Oh, yes, yes. When you see my story, when it comes out, it is just, and it goes beyond just him meeting me. I crashed and burned I was a real estate investor when the market crashed.
All right.
And my father has choreographed a story that I couldn't even dream up. And it involves, I mean, using time travel and using age regression and some of the stuff that they were involved in. And if, you know, if you remember June Crane, you know, was a secretary of his, at least at Wright-Patterson when he was there doing some background engineering.
Sure, and Carol Rosen as well. Well, you keep in touch with us when that book comes out. But, Annie, fascinating, huh?
Yes, it makes me want to, trying to think where you could get some Von Braun DNA.
Yeah, just to confirm. That's a good point. A little paternity check, huh? That would be fascinating.
Well, certainly, you know, it just, I mean.
Confirm it. It confirms it.
Yeah.
One way or another. Did you get involved? Did you come across anything like time travel or anything that they were working on like that?
I didn't. And I'm curious whether that was during the war the caller was talking about, or was that after the war?
When was it, Michael? Well, do you know?
That's a good question, and I'm going to hopefully find that out, because there's rumor that Germany had their own Roswell-type event back in the 30s. I don't know if it's 33, 36, but somewhere in there. There's rumor of that. I don't have any evidence of that, but that supposedly happened. So, you know, they could have been working on this long before they reached, you know. Now, obviously, von Braun's doing the rocket thing, but, you know, when they come over here, we're the whole Operation Paperclip, the brain drain, we're bringing over, you know, people for a lot of years. It wasn't just right after the war. It was even after that. And so, you know, I'm sure if they were working on backward engineering stuff, that it made its way over here. But then we've had our own that, you know, when these things happen, I mean, who are you going to bring in to backward engineer it? Obviously, you know, people from the military industrial complex that are going to be most able to figure this stuff out.
You know, it brings up such an interesting point that there are so many stories yet to be reported. And one that comes to mind just made the papers over Christmas. I had never heard of this before, and it was reported in the British press, I think it was BBC, about the discovery of a giant underground facility in Austria that was Nazi era. And they did a lot of Geiger testing in there and found a lot of evidence, trace evidence, that nuclear weapons work was going on there. So, yeah. A, no one knew about this underground bunker under Austria, and B, they certainly didn't know about the weapons that were being tested there. And this is after 70 years.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think these stories, there's more to be revealed.
They came very close to having the atomic bomb. I mean, very close. So we lucked out there by probably weeks. Let's go to George in San Antonio, Texas now. George, it's your turn. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I thank you for having me, George and Annie. This is really a fascinating subject. When you're mentioning von Braun, I remember I was at a seminar, and we got onto the subject of the Philadelphia experiment. That was built by Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, Tesla was quite an alcoholic, and he was being funded by J.P. Morgan.
That's right.
And they tried the cloaking device by just hitting the switch on and off, and Tesla got very upset by what he started to see happening to the ship, and he, on his own time, would sneak back on board and try to tear the whole system up. Well, they got him off the boat, got him away from the project, and they brought in von Braun to repair it. So him and another scientist repaired it, and then they turned it on for 30 minutes, and then we have the ship absolutely disappearing in the harbor. I can remember when I was a little kid, there was a show on TV called Navy Log. Do any of you remember that?
I sure did, and they definitely cloaked that ship, but who knows what else happened, to be sure. We got to take the break, but we'll come back. On our next Coast to Coast program, join us with Dr. Greg Little as we talk about the American prophet Edgar Cayce and some of the other work that Greg has been working on. Incredible work about pyramid-shaped and mounds in the United States. I'm looking forward to that. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM and wrap things up with your final calls. And welcome back to Coast, Annie Jacobson with us. Annie, how much money do you think these folks got paid, like von Braun, when he was running the space program?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't have the answer. I know that they were paid better than regular military scientists who were working on the same programs. And when you consider that the first 5 years they didn't pay any taxes, and that all expenses were paid, including living, you know, you're looking at a really nice cushion.
It was all bankable. Yeah.
Yes, and also a solid foundation to the American dream.
And how much money do they have stashed away in Swiss bank accounts prior
to that?
Well,
you know, again, I go back to some of the details in the documents you can't make up. When Dr. Kurt Blomma, fresh off the having been acquitted at Nuremberg, Hitler's biological weapons maker, was looking to come to the United States, he was communicating in these documents with a CIA agent about exactly that. He said, I have some money in a Swiss bank account. Will I be able to translate that into dollars? And the trail goes cold, by the way, as to what the answer actually was.
We can only imagine.
Mm.
Let's go to Mike in Illinois. Get things started here, Michael. Go ahead.
Yes, George, this is Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Listen, I just heard on there that Von Braun's illegitimate son is on there, and I want to let you know that I want to declare a couple of things. I was at the University of Iowa. I was the guy that got set up and fired there a few years ago. But James Van Allen, the head of the Vanation Radiation Belt, was named after him, and Von Braun worked together. And he told me this story, and I was a personal friend to Dr. Van Allen. And he explained to me that Wernher von Braun, that the end of the war, that when they tried to, if they tried to implicate him in war crimes, he was told me that he was an honorary member of the SS, which Himmler took over at the end of the war. He did not like the SS, and he was arrested by Himmler personally. And they went to Hitler to free him. But he was not ever a party member. He was never involved in anything but war development. But he was not a party member. He never had anything to do with that. And like I said, Himmler had arrested him. And they said, they went to him and said, hey, we got to have it. Now, as far as the concentration camp goes, I'm, like the lady said, I'm not familiar. But a concentration camp is where they had a lot of political prisoners, and they even had Germans in there. So he probably went to get the scientists or the best pick of the science people to go work on that with him at Bina Munda or wherever it was where they had that. Now, you got to remember, too, George, it's just like everybody gets excited about Middle Eastern people and Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Germans were obligated. They were not all party members. And the war, they were fought against the Bolsheviks, whether they had two evils at the end of the war, as we all know. But Wernher von Braun, as far as I know from what I was told, and I had great respect for him. And I just don't believe that when James Allen told me, he said, no, he was not ever a party member and that he was only given honorary title, which was taken away from him after he was arrested by Himmler. So I'll just
jump in and just clarify for the record, just having looked at the documents in the Bundesarchive in Germany, that Von Braun became an SS Sturmbannführer in 1933, and you are correct that when he was arrested, that was taken away from him, but he was reinstated to the SS on May 1st, 1940.
Willingly.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, he was, it's interesting to look at these documents and to realize how complicated and convoluted the story is. And so I hear with great interest exactly what the caller is saying. And I'm mindful of all these different, you know, stories that come into play and the documents. And I think that's what makes writing nonfiction so interesting, because there are many different pieces of the puzzle. But I did just want to clarify about him being an SS party member, because that is on record as such.
Well, and let me ask you this. We went to great lengths to cover up his background, didn't we?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as I said, and Van Allen, by the way, was also privy to a lot of those conversations because he was so important to the, I mean, you know, when they launched Explorer 1 in 1958, this was an extraordinary triumph. I mean, it had, for months after Sputnik in October of 57, the Soviets were in pole position in that space race. And von Braun and Van Allen, my goodness, by getting Explorer 1 up just a few months later, the entire country breathed a collective sigh of relief, you know, thank God we're not behind the Soviets anymore. So these are all things that need to be taken into account.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Eddie in New York, you're up with us. Go ahead, Eddie.
Hi, George.
Hi there, Eddie.
Great show tonight, and last night you had a great show also.
We're on a roll.
Got me up on YouTube looking the sky up about the alien stuff. My God, it's incredible. Anyway, what I wanted to say was that I wonder if your guest knows that, first of all, full disclosure, UFO disclosure, or as best as you could call it that, was made already about 3 years ago in a television program called Unsealed Alien Files. I watch it all the time. It's still on the air. And I wonder if she knows about that. And because there they mention on the program about Hitler and where he got his technology from. He got it from the extraterrestrials. Are you aware of this?
I'm not familiar with that program.
Well, it's on YouTube, and if I were you, I certainly would see every chapter. I mean, it's in repeats now, and I'm watching the repeats of the past year or two. And it's I learn things more and more from this. And I mean, and they hold back no punches. They pull no punches. They tell you right away what they think it is. And they give you the information right up front. And
one of the things I did come across in my research that sort of ties into this and was so endlessly fascinating was Hitler and Himmler's obsession with the occult. And they really
yes.
did a lot, spent a lot of times doing everything from astral projection to, you know, traveling to the oracle at Delphi in Greece, because this was all very important to the Reich.
Yeah, Hitler was obsessed. And, of course, the Indiana Jones movie was pretty accurate about the Nazis trying to collect everything. And what about the George Clooney movie that was out not too long ago about the Nazi art, the confiscation
yes.
of all the incredible artwork from the Jewish people?
Yes, they had their hands in many pots.
Let's go to Tom in Auburn, New York, first-time caller. Tom, you're up with Annie Jacobson. Go ahead.
Okay. I was wondering why Oskar Schindler saves Jewish lives by getting Jews to work in his factory. He's a hero, but when Arthur Rudolph or Nazi scientists saved Jewish lives from Buchenwald, those people are evil for doing the same thing.
Oh, that's a great question. Well, my take on it is this, and I'm not as familiar with Oskar Schindler's story as you might be, but from what I understand is that he had a turn of heart, so to speak, in that he was part of the Reich and part of the war machine and then decided to save people. And so that very human act is what I think makes him a hero, whereas Rudolf, Ambrose, and others were committed Nazi ideologues, and they absolutely believed in, from my read and research of it, believed in everything that the Reich stood for and pursued it to the bitter, bitter end. And the only reason that they became Americans was to save their hide. And that is my take, but I believe that would be the distinction between a Schindler and a Rudolph and an Ambrose.
Cody in Lake George, Colorado now. Hi, Cody.
Hi, George, and hi, Annie. I've read your book, Area 51, three times, and I wanted an honor to talk to you. It's excellent scholarship. You did a very fine job on that book.
Thank you very much.
But my question was about the SS Occult Division. Were any of the Operation Paperclip guys in the SS Occult Division, and were they brought over here, like Joseph Mengele, you know, who morphed into the Monarch, CIA Monarch mind control program, and especially Von Braun, was he involved in any occult stuff?
I don't believe Von Braun was involved in any of the occult stuff. The most interesting, dark, very dark person who was and who was tried at Nuremberg and executed was a guy named Wolfram Sievers, S-I-E-V-E-R-S. You can look him up through the Nazi doctor's trial. And he ran the division, the occult division. And in some of the program before Operation Paperclip was called Operation Alsace. And the Alsace agents ran into Sievers and found his sort of headquarters and found all these weird things in the basement, literally, from, you know, mummies to necklaces made of teeth and all this bizarre occult and things that were really off base. And it's written, I write about it a little bit in the book, but like I said, Wolfram Sievers, he's probably one of the most bizarre looking Nazis that you'll come across also.
Yeah, and one more question about,
sure.
You talked about the Oracle at Delphi. Was did the Nazis go there and try to get some of the Greek records and get into the occult Greek stuff?
They did. They did. That's fascinating that you know about that, too. There's these great photographs that I came across in the Bundes archives of Himmler and, no, I'm sorry, Goebbels, the propaganda minister. Was led a lot of those efforts, and he took a team of Nazis to Italy and to Greece in search of exactly this kind of stuff we're talking about. And there's these amazing photographs of them not in their usual Nazi paraphernalia that you would expect with swastikas and stuff, but in civilian clothes, kind of like, you know, white linen suits and hats, things like that, on donkeys. Going down into some of the, you know, climbing down on donkeys and into some of these really remote areas to look at the ruins, and there it's strange photography because it's rare to see the Nazis not in Nazi uniform.
Peter in Palisade, Minnesota, it's your turn. Peter, go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I have a question for your guest.
Sure thing.
And my question is regarding the German-Russian non-aggression pact where I think it was Hilger and von Ribbentrop met with the leader of Russia at that time, who was Stalin. And there was said to be a secret protocol to that pact, and I don't know if it was ever revealed. And I was wondering if your guest knows anything about that secret protocol, and did it have anything to do with the Russians arriving first to Berlin, their advancing towards Berlin after the Allies had landed and began making territory towards Berlin. At that time, then the Russians beat us to Berlin after the war had been going on for years. Does she know anything about that?
I don't. I'm wondering if you know any other keywords that might ring a bell. But what comes to mind is that, and this is, you know, speculating, but based on what I know about all that, I would think that whatever, if there were a secret protocol made prior to the invasion, all bets would have been off by the time the Russians arrived in Berlin because of the degree of, you know, the millions and millions of murders that had happened in the interim. I can't imagine that they would honor anything that they had of the past.
It's amazing that Germany's back intact now as a full nation and buzzing along.
Yes, And when I went to do research there, it was amazing to look at some of these old buildings, what they were during the Reich and what they are now.
Are they ashamed of the Nazis of World War II now?
I found German academics and archivists and professors to be incredibly transparent and very helpful, certainly to me, in my research. I never got the sense that anybody was withholding anything. Quite the opposite, that there's like this real desire to, you know, uncover the past. I felt a little different about the man on the street, so to speak. As a reporter, I tend to ask a lot of questions,
sure,
maybe of the hotel concierge, for example, and there was definitely an awkwardness to that, and I think it had more to do with, like, you know, why are you dredging up this stuff? We have a nice country and you're at a nice hotel here, and I really don't want to talk about what happened 70 years ago. And I understand that.
Let's go to Fort Collins now. Burnell, take it away. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, George. Hi, Annie. That last caller, Mike, about the crash, UFO crash, it actually happened in Freiburg, Germany in 1927. And if you want to look for more information, look up the Vril Society. Maria
Ortrich.
Vril Society, B-R-I-L-L?
V-I-R-L, Vril.
Vril, okay.
Vril.
Will do.
Yeah, okay. they must have had some reversed engineer technology, too. Annie, not a lot of time left. Would you give out your websites, please?
Oh, you can read me at anniejacobson.com.
All right. And your books are available at Amazon and I trust all over the place.
All over the place.
Now, what's your next one? You're working on DARPA and you're working on the Pentagon's brain, right?
Yes. The book about DARPA is called The Pentagon's Brain, and it'll publish late summer, early fall.
And will we be just as amazed as we were with the Operation Paperclip?
You know, what happens to me when I get to the end of my books is okay, let me back up. There's two kinds of writers I've learned. There's people who write about what they know, and there's people who enter into subjects without knowing about them. And I am in that second category. In other words, when I take on a subject, I am not an expert, and I would hope to become one. And so what happens is you experience this incredible learning curve, and you also get quite a few revelations, and that certainly happened to me in the Pentagon's brain.
You got it.
And it all has to do with artificial intelligence and robots.
Thanks for being on the program. Really appreciate it. For Brian Opry, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.